Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. All right, boys and girls, listen up. Get your pencils ready. Today's topic is UFOs. And I think I can hear a collective, oh, geez, out there. And that's the standard reaction. It's kind of like talking about Bigfoot, right? But relatively few people spend a lot of time in the deep woods of the Pacific Northwest, whereas thousands of people from all walks of life, all around the world, for many, many years, have reported seeing a UFO, and they include housewives and, you know, substantial business people and retired couples and entire families and, for that matter, military personnel and pilots and government officials, even actually presidents and governors have seen or reported seeing UFOs. And unlike Bigfoot, shows about UFOs and aliens are all over cable TV and movies. I'm sure you've seen it. So despite the immediate common knee-jerk reaction that it's a loony subject, a whole lot of people seem to be interested in it. In fact, a Fox News poll I was reading conducted in 2004 showed that at that time, 34% of Americans believed that UFOs are real. And there are indications that since that time, the number has grown considerably, I guess, maybe partly as a result of the TV shows and so on, to maybe over 50% today. So considering the possible implications of the subject, it's a fascinating topic, and that's why my guest today is Leslie Kane, who's a highly regarded investigative journalist. She's been published in many major mainstream newspapers and magazines over the past couple of decades. Began her career actually covering international politics, in particular in Burma and now called Myanmar, that part of the world, and has written books on the subject. But her new book is called UFOs. It has a subtitle, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. And this book is different from other books on the subject, and we'll explore why in a minute. But, you know, it's a substantial hardcover book published by Random House. It's currently number 35 on the New York Times bestseller list and was recently as high as number 30, which is getting up there on the New York Times bestseller list. So Leslie and the book are highly visible. I first saw her not long ago on the Colbert Report. And it's very well-written, well-reasoned, and a serious, non-sensational book that has a policy objective. So welcome, Leslie.
Well, thanks very much for having me, Court. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you on. So why don't you just tell us what's your book about and how is it different from past books about the UFO phenomenon?
Okay, well, the book is actually presenting the facts about UFOs. And what we're doing is bringing forth the highest level material from the highest level sources and from official sources only. And the subtitle that you read, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials, these are the people that I'm concerned about as a journalist, you know, going to the absolute best sources for UFOs. And as you said, it's not sensational. I have a totally journalistic approach. And one thing that really makes this book different, I think, is that there are 17 chapters in it written actually by various officials who have actually been official investigators or witnesses to this phenomenon. So 17 of the chapters are written by other people than myself. The reader gets to hear directly from these extraordinary people who know a great deal about the subject, some of them firsthand witnesses, and they get to read it in these people's own words, complete with their emotional reactions and, you know, all kinds of revelations and reflections that they've gone through since being involved. So I'm giving people the opportunity, as never before has been done, to read the words of, for instance, five generals. I'm not just quoting these people. I'm letting them have space in the book to write. And that's what really, I think, distinguishes this book. I don't think ever before people have read pieces by generals, for instance, or a former governor of a state in America, or the former head of the Accidents and Investigations Division of the FAA, or Air Force pilots who have actually tried to shoot down UFOs. So I think that's really what makes the book powerful and special, is that particular aspect of it.
Well, I think that's true. And you provide kind of the glue, the introduction to the topic, and then sort of commentary on the different contributions by these high-level contributors. I mean, John Podesta, for example, wrote the foreword. Who was he again?
John Podesta, yeah. He was President Bill Clinton's chief of staff, and he was also the co-chair of President Obama's transition team. So he helped put the cabinet together for Obama. And it's just a very important player within the Democratic Party in Washington. So he's another person who has been interested and kind of been supportive of the work I've been doing for many years. And this is the level of person that I'm trying to bring forward in this book.
And I'm a scientist, and at one point in my career, I wrote some speeches for a man named Dr. Neil Lane, who at the time was the director of the National Science Foundation, which is a very high-level position in American science and, in fact, world science. And I notice he's one of the reviewers, a positive reviewer of your book on the back. So obviously, you've gone out of your way to bring to bear here the highest level, most credible people you can find who are willing to come out on record and talk about their experiences or their attitudes and viewpoints toward UFOs. So who are some of the, just, you know, kind of briefly name them. We don't want to spend a lot of time, okay, you know, going through it, but some of the contributors, for example, in the book.
Sure. And again, what I'm really trying to do is bring forth the kind of information that people like Neil Lane, who did write a blurb, can relate to and accept and are not going to have any trouble. They're not going to be able to dismiss it. It's very serious, straight-ahead information.
Right.
And some of the people that have contributed, you know, we have generals from around the world. I'm hoping that an American general will end up going on the record after this book comes out. But one of them is Major General Wilfried de Bauer, who is from Belgium, and he oversaw the investigation of an incredible wave of UFO sightings in Belgium in the early 90s. And another general is Parviz Jafari from Iran, who was involved with an incident in which he attempted to shoot down a UFO over his country. And we've got Major General Denis Letty from France, who was the originator of this French study called the Cometa Report, which actually was what got me involved with this in the first place. Those are three of the generals. There's another general from Chile and another one from Peru. And then in terms of the governor that I mentioned, Governor Fife Symington of Arizona was governor during the Phoenix Lights incident of 1997, which people may have heard of.
Mm.
Nick Pope was the head of the UK's investigative unit. It's what they call its UFO desk. He spent many years investigating UFO cases for the government of the UK. And so those are some examples. We also have the head of the French agency, and the French agency investigating UFOs is really the primo agency in the world, and we can talk more about that if you want. And the man who headed up that agency for 20 years has written a fascinating chapter about the cases that he investigated and how his government went about exploring this issue. So it kind of gives you a picture around the world of what governments and official bodies have been doing in terms of handling this issue and what some of the pilots and aviation people have actually seen and encountered in those countries.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with journalist Leslie Kane, who is a well-regarded investigative journalist who's written a book called UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. And she was just enumerating some of the very high-placed military officials and government officials that are actual contributors to the book, that have written chapters describing their interaction with this subject in their professional capacity as high-ranking military personnel and government officials. So I think the books on this subject, I think the subject itself, and we'll talk about that in a minute, really kind of first became very visible in this country in the late 40s, but there have been books written on it since the 60s and certainly many since the 80s. And your book has just come out here in 2010. And I think you're a relative newcomer to this subject in general, as far as your interest and your focus on it. How did you come to be involved in it in mid-career? You mentioned a book that you had read that may have prompted you.
Yeah, it was actually a French report. I actually began looking into this in 1999, so it's just been a little over 10 years, and I guess compared to many people, that isn't a very long time. What changed everything for me was this French report called the Cometa Report. And what happened was I was a journalist working for a public radio station in Berkeley, California, a station called KPFA, part of the Pacifica Network, and also was also doing a lot of freelance writing and publishing on various topics. And a colleague from France sent me this report, an English translation of this report that had been done by a group of retired military officials in France, among them four generals, including a four-star, an admiral, and the former head of the French National Space Agency, which is the equivalent of our NASA in France, and a number of other distinguished people. And this report was looking at official data from around the world on the subject. It was mainly militarily focused, so they were concerned with questions of national security and defense and preparedness. That was sort of their motivation, aviation safety also. And they presented a number of fascinating cases, as well as their conclusion, which is really, as a journalist, when I got this report, it was their conclusion that kind of blew me out of the water and made me realize I was dealing with a big story here. And that was that they said that the extraterrestrial hypothesis was the most rational, most valid, and most likely explanation for the cases that they studied. And, you know, I read that and I'm thinking, you have generals saying this, an admiral saying this? Imagine if the equivalent people in America ever came out with a statement like that. What would that mean? And I realized, you know, this is really a big deal for these people to say something like this. they're not fooling around here. And that was the, and what happened was I started to look into this, and I published my first story in the Boston Globe in the year 2000, which was based around this French report that I had received 6 months earlier. And ever since then, I've been pursuing it. I mean, that first story just gave me sort of the confidence to keep going because the response was so overwhelmingly positive to it. It was a long piece. The Boston Globe, they found photographs, and they really put a lot into it. So that's sort of how the whole thing started for me.
All right. So, I mean, I said at the outset that maybe as many as half of Americans believe that UFOs are real, that either they've seen one or they know someone who has, or they are convinced that people do see them. And yet the knee-jerk reaction to it is to laugh at it, or, you know, to treat it like it's a crazy idea. So that kind of defines the concept of a taboo, something you can't talk about. And you describe it that way in your book, as a taboo that applies to UFOs. So how does that taboo work in practical terms?
Well, I mean, I think it's such an important point. I think you're right. It's a knee-jerk reaction. I think it's been so integrated into the culture, and it began back in the 1950s. It's just become so integrated and accepted and sort of the norm that people don't really think about it. And there's, you know, we could talk at length about the roots of that. But that's basically, as you said, when you see the word UFO, a lot of people just think, oh, it's something to laugh at. Well, it's not. That's the bottom line.
So I think that people either at a government level or at a scientific level or in the media, there are kind of three reactions, it seems to me. People either ignore it, or they attempt to debunk it and prove that it's something else, some other more, you know, natural or reasonable explanation, or they laugh at it. And so you mentioned the origins of it. I mean, just briefly, where did that tendency to treat it as a loony topic originate?
Well, I think one of the important points of origination was the CIA panel that was convened back in 1953. It was a group of scientists that were handpicked by the CIA, and they convened this 3 or 4 day meeting with these scientists because they were worried about how to manage the huge volume of reports that were coming in from people. So they got together, these scientists, this was all very secretive, and they issued this report in which they recommended to all the intelligence agencies within the government that they start to debunk UFOs, and they actually used the word debunk, that we need to debunk UFOs in the media, and in any ways we can think of, we need to infiltrate civilian groups. But this was their proposal for how it should be managed. So I think that was sort of one of the points that started the whole thing.
So then there were a couple of panels later on that were prestigious blue ribbon panels that, in reading your book, it's clear that they were just setups. They were kangaroo courts, right? They were set up with a foregone conclusion, and they worked toward that. And so that led to an official conclusion that these things really are all something else. They don't really exist, even though you make it clear in your book that in the actual reports, if you read beyond the executive summary, it's quite clear that some of these things were not explainable. You know?
Exactly, and I think the most important report that you're referring to is what they call the Condon Report. It was a University of Chicago study that was undertaken in the late 60s, and the guy who headed it up, Edward Condon, as you said, already had determined that UFOs were nonsense, and he didn't have any trouble even letting people know that. I mean, the whole thing was just sort of a sham, and they put together a huge report, and he wrote a summary of the report, which he didn't read the whole report. And in his summary, he actually misrepresented the data that was in the report. But the media only read his summary, and that's sort of what went on the record. And this is the kind of thing that does happen a lot. But that report was particularly devastating because it was so high profile, and it kind of put a nail on the coffin for scientists because at the same time, the UFO Air Force unit also shut down. So that was around 1970, and that was a real turning point.
And so it's odd that in our day, the media will pick up and run with anything, and yet one thing they really will still stay away from is UFO reporting, because that taboo of it being a crazy subject is something they're really sensitive to. So it kind of comes out of, again, three sectors, really. It's government, and then the scientific establishment that you just described, and then the media, all in their own ways, I think, kind of suppress the topic. And, you know, and I think anybody who's even loosely aware of it without being particularly interested in it is probably aware that it does get suppressed that way. I mean, I noticed, for example, that all of your contributors, who are all highly distinguished, credible people, I think it's probably true to say that they're all retired or almost all retired, right? So these are people who don't feel free to talk about what they've seen until after they're retired and they're getting their pension and nobody can take it away from them.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, not all of them are retired, but most of them are. You're absolutely right. And the generals certainly are. And I know that from having talked to generals myself off the record in America, or from talking to people who do know generals, They're very sensitive about it, certainly when they're before they're retired, it's out of the question. But even after they've retired, they have their pensions. They're afraid that maybe some things will be denied them, even when they're retired, if they talk about this. So there is a really serious problem with the taboo. And I think it's important to note, though, that it's worse in America than it is in other countries. In other countries, they're much freer to talk about this.
So why do you think the U.S. government continues to approach it this way? I mean, what's the rationale on the part of government for saying we can't really let this information out?
And that's a very hard question to answer. I mean, that, you know, because they really don't give you any rationale. You have to sort of try and figure it out. And
yeah.
I think, you know, as we said, back in 1970, there was just so much devastating stuff that had gone on, both with the CIA panel and with the ending of Project Blue Book and with the Condon Committee. I think it's just become sort of integrated. And most of the political establishment are so concerned about so many other issues that unless something major happens to kind of force this on them, they're just not going to pay attention to it. And so the status quo just maintains itself.
I think at the time of the, during the Cold War, it kind of naturally slid under the blanket of secrecy because the military didn't know but what these were Soviet vehicles or whatever. And I think there was also a fear on the part of some in the early days of that, that it would spark public panic, and it might have 30, 40 years ago. But my gosh, you know, as I said in the beginning, these things are all over TV now. I don't think it's a new and startling concept for pretty much anybody.
I know. I mean, I think the argument for panic is really out of date by now, especially since in other countries, the governments have acknowledged the existence of these phenomena and people have not panicked. So I don't think it would happen here either. The government doesn't have to say that they're extraterrestrial because we don't know what they are. All
right.
They need to do is just acknowledge when something happens, like the O'Hare case in 2006, for instance, that they can't explain what it is. That's all.
Well, I was just going to ask you that next, Leslie. Why don't you give us some examples, just kind of, you know, briefly, of some prominent sightings in the U.S. and abroad in modern times?
Sure, and I think the O'Hare airport case is interesting because it was so recent. Hmm. And in that situation, it also illustrates the lack of government attention that this gets. And in 2006, there was a metallic-looking disc that was hovering over the United Airlines terminal, and it was seen by lots of United Airlines employees as well as pilots and discussed on radios, and the tower was dealing with it, and it was definitely an event. And what happened ultimately was none of the witnesses were willing to go on the record because they were worried about losing their jobs. A lot of them made reports, but not on the record. And number two, the FAA was not willing to acknowledge, first of all, that it happened and tried to make up answers that don't apply. The final answer it gave was that this was weather, which was an impossibility because the kind of weather they were talking about couldn't have happened given the temperatures we had that day. And the whole thing is just, so it's just, that's how it's treated. And these witnesses have seen something, you know, that they can't explain, and they're not given any support by any government officials in terms of dealing with this. They're just sort of told not to talk about it. And it's very difficult for them. And everybody else is curious, and they don't get any answers about it.
What did happen in Phoenix? You mentioned that the governor had written something about the Phoenix sighting.
Yeah, in Phoenix in 1997, there was a number of crafts that were cruising over the state of Arizona for about an hour and a half from about 8:15 to 9:30 in the evening, one beautiful March evening. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people saw it because they called in and reported it. And it turned out that the governor of the state actually saw it himself as well, but he was so afraid of ridicule at the time that he did not tell anyone that he'd seen it except for his wife. And they made a joint decision that it wouldn't be a good idea for him to talk about it, given the implications. So that's sort of an illustration of the, again, what you've brought up, the power of the taboo and how it affects not only average citizens, but officials. We don't know how many other officials may have seen things that they've been afraid to report.
And I remember at the time, Governor Fife Symington, who we're talking about here, actually came out and gave a press conference on it a little while later when the thing did become national news, and spoofed it because he brought out one of his staff people dressed in a hokey-looking spaceman costume and made fun of it and, in effect, debunked the thing that hundreds, maybe thousands of his constituents had seen and reported, and yet he himself had seen it. So that's an example of people who kind of deny the thing even if they have personal experience with it. It's that strong a taboo. It's interesting. But
I know. I mean, that's such an unusual story, and it's so fascinating. And then the end of the story is that 10 years later, he came around and decided he would talk about it.
Yeah.
He's no longer in office. He's not concerned about politics anymore and has since wanted to make amends to his constituents, actually, which is part of his motivation for acknowledging it. And now he wants to help change government policy. So his story is really a fascinating one, and he's actually written his own chapter, his own piece for the book as well.
Okay, well, here's the thing. I mean, any rational person would ask, all right, so I'm open to the idea that these things exist and that they cruise around in the airspace of the world sometimes in ways that are visible and more visible than others at different times. But the problem is that there's a lack of hard, tangible evidence. I mean, none of them have, you know, crash-landed in Central Park or whatever. So as far as we know, anyway, that there's a lack of hard, tangible evidence, it may be that some exists and we don't know about it, right? But what forms of evidence are there that we clearly do know about in a provable way?
Okay, well, there are forms of physical evidence, but again, like you say, no retrieved craft that we know of. But what we do have is multiple witness sightings where a lot of people in different locations see the same thing. We have radar, which is, radar tracings that correspond with visual sightings, and radar only picks up physical objects unless it's an aberration, but the operators can distinguish that. We also have some superb photographs that have been completely vetted and tested through scientific laboratories. And we have physical effects on aircraft that have been documented, where if a passenger plane, say, is near a UFO, it's either pulled off course sometimes, other times it loses the ability to operate certain equipment inside the cockpit. And the other thing is actual physical evidence on the ground when a UFO has landed. Circles on the ground or holes from where the landing gear touched down, effects on soil, effects on plants, and all of this can be studied in the lab. So those are some of the best aspects of evidence that we have.
So you mentioned that other governments around the world are more open to this and less kind of imposing this taboo than the U.S. does. And you described the report that came out. That was an unofficial group of French former officials, right? But what governments, just kind of briefly, you know, without getting into a lot of detail, what governments around the world are more open to this, and in brief, what do they do?
Right. Well, I would have to give France the gold medal because they've had an agency since the mid-70s set up in their space agency, which is the equivalent of our NASA, and it's very scientifically oriented. It's not a military organization. They've just done great research for decades, and it's all available. The UK has had a UFO agency for many years. They recently closed it, but it's operated from the 1950s until 2008. Belgian Air Force has been involved. The Brazilian Air Force is very involved in doing investigations. And both Chile and Peru also have specific agencies that are set up specifically and only to deal with UFOs. Other countries in South America as well. And we've gotten a lot of reports from Russia. But I think those key countries in Europe and in South America are the ones that I'm most familiar with and that actually have agencies set up for the purpose of investigating UFO cases and have collected a lot of important data.
We're talking with journalist Leslie Kane, who has written a very authoritative book, really, on UFOs. And in your book, Leslie, you make the point that UFO, unidentified flying object, has come to mean, in most people's mind, extraterrestrial. It's a spaceship from outer space. And what's your view of that?
Yeah, I mean, and I'm so glad you brought that up, Court, because it's a terrible misunderstanding that people think that, as you said, the acronym UFO means an alien spacecraft. So people say, do you believe in UFOs? Well, the point is that the acronym actually means something unidentified. That's all it means, and the Air Force has defined it that way. So the question, do you believe in UFOs, really isn't applicable because the data shows that there is a physical phenomenon that we call UFOs. It actually does physically exist without question. And we have to be clear that we don't know yet what it is. We cannot assume that these are extraterrestrial spacecraft because that has not been determined yet to a level of scientific acceptability that we need. So basically, we've got to remember a UFO simply means something unidentified, an unidentified flying object. And it's not necessarily flying either, but it's certainly unidentified.
Yeah, and they're not always flying saucers. They come in all kinds of shapes and sizes and different kinds of lights, but, you know, there's no point in cataloging that. But I think people can buy your book and read about some of these descriptions that people are writing about in your book. And so apart from the idea of whether they're extraterrestrial or not, if you accept that what people see are real phenomena, at least some of the time, right? And much of the time they're not. They're explainable natural phenomena or they're human phenomena. But if you accept that at least some of the time it's really something not explainable in normal terrestrial terms, not made by humans, then it seems to me that they're one of either three things. They either are extraterrestrial or they're kind of extra-dimensional or they're time-shifted in some way. I mean, maybe, you know, I'm just thinking speculatively here, but this is a subject that lends itself to speculation because we don't know much, right? So it's possible, I guess, that, you know, humans in the future come back in time and look at us in the past, right? I guess that your point is that we don't know. It could be any of those things, really. We don't really know. And one of the main points that skeptics make, and there are some people who kind of almost make a, a profession out of debunking UFOs, is that travel from even the nearest star at the speed of light would take several thousand years, so therefore it's not possible that these would be vehicles from even the nearest star. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, again, I'm not a physicist, but I happen to know that there are numerous physicists who contradict that and can show through their own theoretical work that time travel is possible in ways other than directly physically from one star to another that would take thousands of years, namely through things like wormholes and bending space-time. And Michio Kaku, the famous physicist who's written numerous books, is one of the people that talks a great deal about the possibility of a much faster means of time travel if the civilizations we're talking about were well in advance of ours. We're talking thousands or even millions of years. Just about anything is possible when you look that far into the future, and we cannot assume that civilizations that far ahead of us would not be able to find a way to travel quickly through space. And physicists can actually show how it could happen. So I think those other theories are kind of outdated at this point.
You know, again, what's lacking here, I think, is just really an undeniable proof event. I mean, a vehicle flying low and slow over Central Park at lunchtime or crash landing on the Capitol Beltway in Washington or something. And without that, it comes down to belief. In other words, faith. People say they believe in UFOs. And really, that's not the way I function. I don't believe in something offhand. You know, I have to kind of see something. But without that kind of proof, it can't really compete or even coexist with the accepted faith-based belief system, which, of course, is religion. So we'll see what happens in the future. But I know that you and your contributors in this book call for a small but quite radical change in the U.S. government's approach to this issue. So what is it in a nutshell?
Yeah, we would like to see a small office set up, and again, we're sort of using France as a model for this, a small office that would not cost very much because it might even only have one staff person in it, that would just sort of be an official focal point for UFO investigations. It would coordinate with other agencies around the world that already exist. It would try to bring out more files from our own government that have not been released, but most importantly, it would be set up to investigate events that happen, such as the O'Hare case that we talked about earlier. If this agency were in place, that case could have been properly investigated. Everybody would go on the road. All the data would be made available to this agency very quickly, and the agency could give a report made public as to what they learned about it. And this would be the responsible way to handle these events, and we think that setting up an agency like this would be the way to accomplish that and would open many doors to future resources being provided for scientists so that we can learn a lot more about them and maybe even figure out what they are.
Well, you know, I think there are really only two big questions for humanity. The first is there life after death? And the second is, are we alone in the universe? And I think everything else is just details, really. And you're after an answer to the second question. We wish you luck in that, because it is a very important question. You can buy the book UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record at Amazon, at Barnes & Noble, and Borders, and so on. Basically, every bookstore has it. You can read about the book at its dedicated website. Get ready, UFOs on the record, UFOs on the record, just like it sounds, .com. Leslie Kane, thank you so much for being on with us. As usual, we could talk for another half hour about this subject, but we only have a short time on American Variety, and thank you for being on with us to talk about it.
Thanks a lot. I wish we had more time, but it's been great. Thanks for having me, Court.
Thanks to all of you for listening, and I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.